Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We did shoot in Kazakhstan, where you really, you couldn't mess about with your vehicles. And all the crew and the safety people would take a Discovery, but they wouldn't take a Range Rover.
And we'd have an afternoon whizzing round and round the farm, see who could go fastest, demolish most of Hertfordshire.
I got down on my knees and grabbed hold of Sterling Moss's ankle. And they were both wetting themselves with like, what are you doing? That was a joke. I was like, sorry.
Hello and welcome to episode 49 of the Collecting Addicts podcast. That's my dog barking. And he's excited because Chris Cooper tells us that within a couple of days, this is the 1 year anniversary of us first recording together, which is an amazing accomplishment for all of us, given that everyone's so busy apart from me. Everyone else has real jobs. So today, we'll start with something of medium temperature, but still pertinent to driving in the UK, maybe America as well. Why will the Discovery 4 always rule? Why, whenever I see a Discovery 4, do I go, that's the best thing they've done in the last 20 years?
Yep.
Now, this was proposed by Neil Clifford, who I often go to first, but this time I'm going to go to Chris Cooper, who I believe, like me, is a great fan of this car.
I am. It's peak Land Rover. It's peak Land Rover. If the Ineos Bombardier, bomb loader, gun carriage, grenadier thing is a reverse TARDIS, this is TARDIS. This is an actual TARDIS. It is bigger on the inside than you think it's going to be. And it's better than the Discovery 3. Discovery 3, some of the styling bits of Discovery 3, I think are a bit neater, a bit simpler. But it had that 2.7 V6 diesel engine, which wasn't really quite up to the job. Although, if you can find a unicorn V8 Discovery 3
manual,
normally aspirated V8, that's a thing. That's mm-hmm. a thing. But Disco mm-hmm. 4 with the 3 litre, the SD6, so 258 horsepower. If it was a dog, it'd be a Labrador. Other dogs are available. Other lovely dogs are available. Neil, you've got a very, very lovely Ridgeback. But occasionally, you might want a Ridgeback to bite something. But a Discovery never would. A Discovery would never bite anybody. It would just want to help. It would just reach out its doors and reach out to everybody and say, I can do that. I can help. Oh, it'll be fine. It'll be no problem.
Labrador.
Whatever you want to do, I can do. It is the Labrador. And there was a period, I've talked to the boys about this, and they said, it's not, the problem is, for the TOF trucks for TOFs, Range Rovers, is that it's gone a bit, Discovery 5 was completely, I mean, what's that number plate thing that, Jerry, it's you again, that silly number plate thing.
You can visualise Discovery 5 as a car. It's a rare thing, but actually, you don't need to speak. So viewers will now see what Discovery 5 is.
Yeah, it is.
That's what it is.
It's no friend of ours. So I think it's peak Land Rover. It's just the best thing. It will always. We've got one. We bought it in. Ooh. Yeah.
Oh God, look at it.
Yeah.
That's a Fulham scene if ever you see one.
What's the collective noun? What's the collective noun for more than one Discovery 5?
Tell us, Christopher. Make it up.
Gag. Gag of discos.
Is it a wank?
I was trying to be a bit more polite.
Wank of discoveries.
And you could get a very, very briefly, you could get a Discovery 5 in green, but then Jerry decided that was far too rural and acceptable. In some point in the early 2010s, anybody who's anybody had a Discovery 4. Didn't have a Rangey, had a Discovery 4. We've got one we bought in 2016.
Are you saying that you're one of the people that was somebody?
Once. When I was fast. I was once somebody. you actually asked us to sell it to you, Monkey, when you were here, when we were going to Spa.
Lovely car. It was a lovely car.
My father-in-law, Lynn's father, John, had it for a few years. I mean, very sadly, passed away a bit ago, and we got it back. And we'll never sell it. We'll sort of make sure it still goes. No, I think it's peak Land Rover. It was the real TARDIS. Discovery 5, no. The Defender 90... I know, Edward. I know you love it, but that is a inverse TARDIS.
The modern one.
Yeah,
I like it really.
I like it as well, but it just Discovery 4 is unpretentious and it works, and it's the right shape. You get more in it. Peak Land Rover.
Yeah, I agree. So let's speak to Edward Lovett, who probably doesn't really give a shit about this subject.
No, I've never been in one.
I've never wanted
to be in one. I've never needed to own one. I'm all right, thanks.
What do you say to that?
Over to you, Manish.
Manish, do you feel as passionately about Discovery 4?
Maybe not quite as dispassionately. A friend of mine who has two boys and a beautiful red lab has had one, for absolutely years, and it used to occasionally give my son and me a lift to football. And on the rare occasion that my wife would also join us, you had his wife, so you had four adults, three kids, so seven of us sitting as if we were in a lovely sort of car. I mean, they are unbelievably big cars, and with two dogs, we had Tuco and Bella as well. We were absolutely fine. And there were little tiny details. This friend of mine is in the motor racing business. He used to commentate, and now he does something else. But he chooses his cars very carefully. His father was actually a Works Lotus driver and competed and won his class at Le Mans back in the 60s. So he's, his daddy was very quick. And this guy, he's quite well known. And he chose this car because he really wanted something that he could drive around in London with and do a school drop off. But they've got this fantastic place up in the lakes, and they do a bit of off-roading there. And this car's amazing. Yeah. This car's amazing. It does both. But I will end with the RAC reviews, rather pithy assessment of the car. They described it as Solihull's clever and classless masterpiece.
Well, that's good. Who wrote that? The RAC?
Yes, it's in the RAC review. And I thought it was beautiful because that car doesn't scream, oh my God, at you when you see that in London. No. The fact that it really can work off-road. Those guys have sat down and gone, no, no, no. This is a Land Rover. Just, it's our modern version of it. But that's an amazing achievement.
No G-Wagon.
Yeah, it's more attractive. You're right. It's remarkable that vehicle. I think we now realise that we sometimes vehicles become instantly iconic, and that was from the moment it was released. It was just a brilliant piece of styling. It was a great piece of proportioning. It just looked right. A bit like a racing car. Sometimes you see a racing car, I think that looks right. It's going to be fast. Discovery was always the same. I think rarely for a car. I slightly disagree with Chris Cooper in that I think the facelift, as in the Disco 4. Is better looking than the Disco 3. Some of the plastics on the Disco 3 look a bit ham-fisted and have aged really badly, whereas a Disco 4, to me, still looks like it could have been built yesterday.
Well, Disco that's
3,
true.
Disco 3 looks quite old, and the interior on the Disco 3, if you look at it now, is a bit Fisher-Price, whereas the Disco 4's we've got one at Grip, and it, well, Neil drives it the whole time.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic vehicle. And I, maybe, here's the question, and I'll pose it to Neil Clifford as I hand over now. Do we look so fondly upon the Disco 4 because it's because its successor was so shite? If the 5 had been magnificent, would we have forgotten about the 4 because we wouldn't need to celebrate it? Because it wouldn't, because it wouldn't remind us how hit and miss Land Rover can be. What do you think, Neil?
No, I think the 5 is all, the 5 is almost invisible, isn't it? It's so crap that everyone's totally ignored it.
Yeah.
I always call this, to be slightly controversial, I always call it the Discovery 3, because the 4 is the facelift. Really, the big jump forward was the 3, wasn't it?
Yeah, 2 to 3 2003
or 2004. In fact, Emma and I bought one in 2005-6. It was almost our first sort of grown-up, let's go to a dealership and buy a car because, oh, shit, we've got children and a Lancia Integrale is not a sensible enough four-door car, which I bought for that reason of going to pick up Ruby in 2000 from the hospital, traded in.
Did you still live in central London at the time, Neil?
Yeah. I lived in Muswell Hill, and I went to Howard Wise and traded in an M3 Sport Evolution E30 for 12 grand and put, exactly. We've all got these little stories. This is definitely one for a subject once, isn't it? An extra 1500 quid and I got a candy red dealer collection Integrale four door because I needed a four door car to put a kid seat in the back.
Yeah.
But then we obviously realized that's not very sensible. We went and bought Discovery 3, and I think that was such a leap forward. It was really the jump into the modern era. And it, I think the 3 is much prettier than the 4. And actually, when you study it, the interesting thing, I know we may be a little bit over tough on our friend Jerry. Jerry didn't design the 3, he fucked up the 4.
Yeah.
I think the 4 looks better.
No.
Well,
it doesn't. It's not.
I think
3 is like a Tonka toy. I think it's completely clean, both interior, in terms of its symmetry, its pureness, its off-road capability, just standing there, you can see this thing could go across mountains. I think it got a bit fussy with the 4.
The grill's a bit fussy.
Yeah.
Here's a poser for you. This is one of the few car companies that was willing to shamelessly hang on to its iconic vehicle, the Defender, or whatever you called it back in the day, for decades and decades and decades. I think that if we say the 3 and the 4 are the same basic shape.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I think it was iconic enough, and it was such a sales success that I wonder why they didn't run with that and say, well, let's have a vehicle that looks vaguely like this for the next 30 years.
Well, they should have. That was a mistake. Yeah. And in fact, the new Defender really is the evolution of that.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. It is.
The Defender 5.
Chris, how does that fit into your theory of car manufacturers always know what we want and they always get it right, even if we don't know that they do?
No, I don't say that. I just think they know more than we give them credit for. Of course they make mistakes, but I think the worst thing they could do is to clinic customers in order to make cars. If you make what a customer tells you they want at that time, well, you take that information too seriously. You know, you don't know what sort of day they've had. Also, when you go into a clinic, you think you go into the mindset of thinking, trying to be clever, want to make a statement. If you walked in and said, just make the one you made before, but a bit better, they wouldn't believe you. But that's what most of the time is what you want to say, isn't it?
Yeah, so, I think the bit, even now, because at the weekend I had to do something, I had to move a go-kart at the weekend, like a racing go-kart, boys have used, and I occasionally had to go in. And if you put the third row down, which you'd have down most of the time, the boot floor is completely flat. You put the middle row down, the boot floor is completely flat.
It's clever.
Can't do that in a Defender, the current Defender.
No.
I like the interior as well on that 3-4 thing. I think it's chunky.
It's just brilliant.
The only Land Rover I've ever been in a professional situation where it was afforded the same respect as a Land Cruiser. Like we did a couple of shoots in Africa, and we did shoot in Kazakhstan where you couldn't mess about with your vehicles. Yeah. And all the crew and the safety people would take a Discovery, but they wouldn't take a Range Rover.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's iconic. And I think, you know, if Land Rover was wondering what they should do with the next Discovery, it's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Yeah. We're here for you.
Or is that the Defender, as Neil says? Is that now?
Well, I think Defender's doing that job now, but I'm sure they can. Yeah, I'm sure there's a gap between Defender and Range Rover, isn't there?
Yeah, there is.
I'm not sure there is, because a heavily spec'd, fancy long wheelbase Defender's quite a bit of kit now, isn't it?
It's a lot of money, but it still isn't quite as roomy inside. That's the problem.
Well, they're trying to, I suppose the strategy was, let's have a Macan stroke KN thing that's a bit, but that isn't really what Discovery 5 did.
No.
You got caught between the worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
It is, it's peak Land Rover, it's the Labrador. Every home should have one. Edward, even yours.
Yeah.
I'll have the Labrador.
I'd buy one now if I could, you know, we're all searching every week on noticeable websites, which I can't name, but for a manual V8.
Yes, yeah, if you have a low mileage manual V8,
unfortunately, they just don't exist. There isn't one.
There was briefly in the Disco 4, there was a 5-litre normally aspirated.
Yeah.
Oh, they did do that, did they? Yeah.
Did a 5-litre one in the facelift car, but I think they were mainly left-hand drive.
Yeah.
And they all went. But the, you know, those who know have got their, I think it was a 4-litre, 4.2 normally aspirated.
4.4.
Was that a BMW engine or not? Was the 5-litre the BMW?
No, it wasn't BMW engine.
TVR.
It was...
What year are we talking about?
2004, 2005, 2006.
That was a Jaguar engine.
Yeah,
I think. Was it not? It wasn't the 4.4. Okay, so someone will come on and correct us.
It was a 4.4.
It wasn't the BMW 4.4, was it?
Wasn't that? No, because that was the
4.4. No,
it was all
the 4.4.
We sound like the two old surgeons in Harry Enfield now, don't we? Was it the 4.4?
45?
What a fabulous bottle of Burgundy this is.
45.
Right. Okay.
Gyro. That's somebody else.
So my this was proposed on a message from a good friend of mine who's currently on holiday in the Maldives, where I think he's just getting very wet and blown around the place. So to T, I'm sorry that you're having a windy time, but your suggestion of who would your 5 motoring heroes be to invite to a dinner party, both dead or alive, I thought was rather good. And it could take up a bit of time, but we've got a bit of time, so let's go on with it now. Let's start with Edward Lovett. First of all, would you cook for them or would you take them to the canteen?
That's a very good question. It would have to be the canteen, Christopher. Yep. As you've given me the choice, then it'll be the canteen. So most of them are alive. One of them's not. James Hunt.
Okay.
Kimi Raikkonen.
It's a dinner party, not a piss-up. You know that,
you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah. Not to the canteen.
I've put John McGuinness.
God.
Chris Harris. So far, I've got... And I'm obviously at the table as well, so there's 6 of us. So we all turn up a bit early.
That's only 4.
No, that's 4 so far. I've got
okay,
the 6th is coming. So we all turn up early, and because we met at the pub down the road first, get a few in before we go for dinner.
Is that called these days?
We sit at the table. Chris is already behaving appallingly, and I'm having to apologise to the staff at the canteen, saying, look, I'll try and keep him in check. And we're waiting for the final guest as a bit of a surprise, and of course this person would always turn up fashionably late, and he arranged to have the trees cleared outside the canteen so he could land in a helicopter, and out of the helicopter he gets in the most beautifully tailored suit, and Luca de Montezemolo walks and sits at the table with these 5 half cut reprobates.
Yeah.
Oh, and puts us, put, puts us all in check.
Dear me, can you imagine? Can you imagine him trying to understand John McGuinness? Sorry. Love it.
I think he would be enlightened by the experience.
Let's go for Chris Cooper's.
So I talked about this with the boys, and their suggestion, which is not my suggestion, because I had a slightly different take on this, was Stefan Beloff, Duncan Hamilton, Tony Rolt, and Donald and Malcolm Campbell. I know it's too many, but hey, this is a fantasy.
Oh, the Campbells.
And Roger Penske.
Okay.
To pay for the whole thing, get it in order. But my take on it was, I sort of said this last night in our little chat, British rally legends have all died too young. Roger Clark, Tony Pond, Colin McRae, Richard Burns, all taken from us too young. Tony Pond, probably for the younger viewers, you have to go and look him up. He was this incredibly, there's a bit of him in all of them. They were all quite laid back in their way. They were all utter gods. And the whole point of a dinner party is you want to do it with some people you have fun with, who aren't there to prove anything to anybody else. You just want to have fun with. So what I'd do, I'd invite them all around to the farm. There's one more guest to come. I'd invite them all around to the farm. And at the bottom of the farm, actually, you guys are all going to come and see us in some way. The bottom of the farm is a little valley, runs the length of the farm. And at one end of it, there's a beautiful little Dingle Dell type. We call it Dingle Dell. Beautiful sort of little opening with some trees. And you could put a big, like, wartime old mess tent in it. And we'd have a barbecue. And the other person I'd invite would be David Richards. That's a bit self-serving. He's a mate and a colleague of mine. But the reason why we'd invite David, because I think he's worked with all of them. I'm not sure about Roger Clark, but the rest of them clearly have. So Richard and Colin.
That's cool.
And I think he was a co-driver for Tony Pond in the late 70s. So apart from wanting David could pay for the whole thing. Sorry, David. Because he's a fantastic host. He runs two hotels down in Cornwall. I'm a big fan of him. So forgive me for my self-interest. And he would bring some toys for us to play with. He'd bring the ProDrive Hunters that are currently, fingers crossed, in the hands of Sebastian Loeb, possibly about to win the Dakar Rally as we're recording this week in Saudi. So you'd have Roger, Tony, Richard Burns, Colin, David and me trying to keep order. And we'd have an afternoon whizzing round and round the farm, see who could go fastest, demolish most of Hertfordshire in these two wonderful ProDrive Hunter off-road monsters. And then in the evening, we'd do a barbecue. I can't cook, but I can do a barbecue. And we'd have a barbecue and a few beers down the bottom of the valley. Nobody could hear us. Nobody could see us. That would be a dinner party from heaven. That's what I'd do.
That's very good.
Nice.
Clearly, you're disqualified because you actually came up, between you and the boys, you came up with about 15 guests.
Yeah, so, you know. But hey, this is a fantasy.
Neil Clifford.
Oh, this was a tough one. This is one of the toughest ones I've had to think about, actually. And I concluded, and I'm 4 dead, 1 alive. I don't know whether that's...
So am I, actually. Same mix as me.
Yeah, me too. Yeah,
I'm 4 dead, 1 alive.
No, I'm 3 dead, 2 alive, sorry.
Okay. And I did the people, and then after it, I worked out why they are thus. And as I've mentioned many times before, too many times, I'm dyslexic. I don't really read stuff. I look at pictures. But there are 5 journalists who I do enjoy reading, and therefore they obviously do something to my brain to make me concentrate and make me read that others don't. And they are Alan Clark. Obviously, he wasn't just a journalist. He was an all right general legend as a member of parliament. But I've read his book 100 times. Dennis Jenkinson, who, you know, was just a total legend very early on. And I caught him later, but loved the chap. LJK Setright. Be it that I read a lot. I don't understand any of it, or certainly about 5% of what he writes.
It sounds good.
It's more about the character I'm so sad that I was never even just able to meet him for 2 minutes. Russell Bulgin, because for me, he was the guy of the 90s. And it sounds a little bit sort of subservient or blowing smoke up his ass. Chris Harris. But it's not just about the way Chris writes. And Chris writes better than he says he does. And everyone, you know, everyone I speak to has enjoyed your book, Chris. It's more about having you there as a character, because you would orchestrate the whole thing beautifully. And we'd be in the Guinea Grill in Mayfair, in the private dining room, and have massive steaks and beautiful, really decadent red wine, roast potatoes, cauliflower cheese, sticky toffee. You know, it will be like 1 billion calories and 4 million bottles of red wine. And I couldn't do that without having Chris there, because he would be able to...
As long as I'm there as conductor, I like that. I'll take
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you can conduct the whole thing, and it would just, you know, I'd pay a lot of money for that.
Sort of what I do here, really, just keep...
Yeah, but also you would laugh a lot, and it would just be brilliant fun.
Yeah, it wouldn't. You wouldn't miss us at all, would you? I mean, the rest of us.
Yeah. Well, of course I wouldn't.
Yeah. We weren't invited.
That's a lovely group. I like this one. This is Manish.
I was thinking about different aspects of cars and conversation and time. And I was thinking about somebody could be technical, somebody could be witty, somebody who was a little bit like me from the outside, who'd contributed in no small way, even though she probably had no idea at the time what she was doing. So my main guess would be, or my first guess would be, Professor Sid Watkins. I mean, I loved him. I absolutely loved him. I got to know him for 2 or 3 years. And in fact, the last day I met him was 4 days before he died.
Wow.
And you know, he was a very special man. And I loved him because he was so irreverent. And he was a little repository of secrets. Oh, my days. Yeah.
Did you know him? Nice. Did you know him sort of medically, professionally, or motorsport?
No. If I had met him as a medical student or a junior doctor, I'd be a neurosurgeon. There is no way I'd have had anything to do with it. I mean, he was just so far beyond a legend. You meet someone and you just click. And he used to introduce me, because I met him obviously through Senna. And he used to introduce me in Formula One as a failed neurosurgeon. He said, that's why he does orthopedics. There was no way a neurosurgeon would train someone as handbag. In fact, little segue, he introduced me to Stirling Moss. And do you remember when Stirling Moss stepped into his lift, but the lift wasn't there, and he fell his ankles?
Dreadful.
So I remember this. It was Silverstone 2010. And somebody wheeled Sir Stirling in a wheelchair. He had a blanket on. And he said, come on, lad, I want to meet you to, I want to introduce you to Stirling. So he said, Stirling, this is Manish. Manish, this is Stirling. So I went to shake Sir Stirling's hand. He said, don't shake his hand, examine his ankles. So what I did was like a reflexive medical student. I got down on my knees and grabbed hold of Stirling's ankle. And they were both wetting themselves with like, what are you doing? That was a joke. I was like, sorry, bro. Anyway, so and he knows everything about everyone, everything. And he can be fantastically indiscreet. And he loved Glen Morangie. So the Professor Sid Watkins, my second guest, definitely has been dead for a while, but it would be Dorothy Padgett. I would love to meet the person who financed the Bentley blower. And she financed it for Birkin. She sat down and thought we needed to win Le Mans, and that was the way to do it. And she put her own money into it. And I love people like that. Somebody, she was an okay driver. This isn't something that she could ever have experienced personally, but she financed that blower program, and you know, through thick and thin. And I think she would have been fascinating. She lived, what was the castle she lived in? It was in Kent. Was that
in when
it was in Kent?
She had Hever Castle.
I can't remember, but she lived in this magnificent castle. I mean, she was cool. She made that happen, and And I think that's massive. The guy I think who would keep us all laughing at Prof Deden would be Clive James. It just could write anything. Very, very clever, brilliant, brilliant Italian speaker. I didn't get to know him very well, but and he was, of course, the ultimate F1 guru. His sort of comments on those early F1 tapes were just so pithy and brilliant. And in fact, if you read one of his books, what he tells you about, do you remember the Las Vegas Grand Prix of, I think it was either, well, it could only have been one of two, so it was either 81 or 82. He said that Princess Stephanie was there, and she was going out with Alain Prost, and they were filming. It was 81. It was Clive James in Las Vegas. And he said, you know, at that time, they just couldn't film her, and all the footage they had to kind of destroy. And it was just a hell of a circus. The next guy can't speak English, and the fifth person would have to do some translating, but it would be wonderful just to have him because of his aesthetic sense, and that's Marcello Gandini. He's still alive, and I could just listen to him. I've seen so many YouTube interviews with him as to how he goes about the process of design, how he literally imbues every curve, every arc, just sees things in a way that we don't, and I'd just love to have him. And of course, Edward Lovett has to have the fifth dinner. It has to be Luca. And this, you know where this dinner
is? I thought you were going to invite Edward.
I thought you were inviting me. I was the translator.
I would if we do Chris's rules.
How does he feel?
No, it'd have to be Luca. And I'll tell you,
Eddie,
you would do this dinner. He has this amazing, he has a lovely terrace behind his villa in Bologna, but even better than that, they've got a pizza oven in this kind of area that's got a roof on it. And to have fresh pizza, a bottle of Montezemolo red or two or 10 with these characters on a summer evening, candlelit in President Montezemolo's garden, would be my dream dinner.
Beautiful.
All of these I want to be present at. So I've overlapped a bit, but not as much as I thought. The only name that I'm going to repeat is not what is not. There were two mentioned. I want someone that's gone really fast and just speed for the sake of speed. So I want Malcolm Campbell there because it's a discipline that I've never. I'm too scared to take part in it. I these people that were so driven just to go fast and knew what the risks were.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I just love them. So I'm going to go for Malcolm. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Ari Vatanen is just, he's my hero. Yeah. I just think he's amazing. Yeah. And I think he's a natural raconteur. So this is a difficult one. I don't think you can just go for your heroes. You've got to imagine what they'd be like around that table.
Haven't
you?
Absolutely.
Totally.
So I think Ari, I don't know. I've read a bit about Malcolm Campbell. I think he'd be up to the task. Ari Vatanen, yes. The third one is a bit weird, but I wanted someone from the motor racing era where they risked it all, but who isn't the obvious character, but who I think wrote the best motorsport book of all, and that's the unfair advantage. I want Mark Donohue there, because I think that book demonstrates that in the right company, he could speak about the sport and about how human beings interact with speed and racing in a way that no one else can. And at the very least, I want to ask him, how did you write that book? It's so good. The next one, I'm amazed no one's mentioned it so far, but I think he might be the most influential person in the motor industry in our times loving cars, and that's Ferdinand Piëch. Why wouldn't you want Piëch there?
Mm.
He'd probably tell us all what to do. He'd tell us how we could sit, what cutlery we could use, and he'd feel underneath the table to make sure there are no sharp edges for our shins to bump into. And he'd disconnect the air conditioning, I'm told, as well, because he hated it. But Piëch just has to be there because he's the boss. Yeah. You could sit there and say, so you did the Audi Quattro, the 917, the Veyron, and just about every fast 911. It's not a bad CV, is it?
No.
And the only person I want from the modern era there is someone who, until recently, I wasn't even a fan of. In fact, I'd say he was one of my least favourite F1 drivers for a long time because I couldn't quite understand the way he did things. But now I think he might be an absolute legend, and that's Sebastian Vettel. I think Vettel would be the best dinner guest because he's clearly interested in the subject. He's clearly very funny, has a great sense of humour.
Very.
And I think he'd have some great stories to tell. So, strangely, if someone said to me, which F1 driver, it would be, I wouldn't even think about it. It would be Sebastian Vettel.
Yeah, I think that's a really good call.
That's my group.
Yeah, I think that's a really good call. I think it's funny how Sebastian's gone the low point of that wheel-banging
road race thing in Baku, where he literally wanted, you know, he almost did a Dan Ticktum on Lewis Hamilton. And he went from that to where he is now, where he's clearly, he's always been funny. And mates of mine who worked at Red Bull said he's just really, very bright and very funny. The Campbell thing is interesting, isn't it? I can't remember. You just go down wormholes and stuff, don't you? And I remember on Sunday evening, I ended up looking at a load of stuff about Donald Campbell. So in 1967, he died on, is it Coniston Water? Lake Coniston, on the second run of two runs to set a new world water speed record. It's estimated that on the second run, where the thing took off and he was killed, he was doing 330, 340, someone will correct us in the comments. That would still be faster now than the current world water speed record. That's how fecking dangerous and sketchy that is.
Yeah, it's Campbell's. Just unbelievable.
Campbell's, what were they like?
There's just something about guys who will do crazy speed on water. Yeah. You remember, you know, what killed Pironi wasn't a Ferrari, it was a speed. No. It almost killed
cows, Torquay cows, Parbo.
By the way, in a few weeks' time, we'll revisit this and we'll ask the fellow addicts, the people that didn't crack their lists, because I've got 20. And I'll tell you now, my Malcolm Campbell was so nearly Craig Breedlove, because if you read his first book,
yeah,
I mean, what amazing character. Absolutely. Yeah. Google him afterwards. Craig Breedlove.
And Art Arfons, the other guy.
Oh, dearie me.
Those two who were just trading in the late 60s, mid-late 60s, just trading the land speed record. Oh.
Have a look. If you Google Donald Campbell's E-type, he had a matching E-type to his boat.
He did.
And it's DC7 registration number parked on the lake next to the boat.
His boat number was K7.
Just mega cool.
Yeah.
Right, we're moving on. So we go from something definitive and lovely to something that could end up being quite weird. How to be a passenger in a car? Are you a good passenger in a car? Are you a bad passenger in a car? I can't even look at Chris Cooper in this because I've ridden shotgun so many times and our attitudes towards that role differ quite severely on what one is allowed to do and not, what is authorised and what is not. So first of all, I'm going to go to someone who probably didn't even think about this, Edward Lovett. What's your strategy when you're a passenger in a car?
Well, first of all, on the track, I think I've covered this. But the last time I'll be a passenger on a racetrack was at Yas Marina almost 2 years ago with you, Monkey.
Oh, okay.
And that says a lot because I trust you being a passenger in a car, but I don't need to put myself at risk being a passenger in the racetrack on a car. And it confirmed to me that day that I won't be doing it again. So that it's quite exhilarating.
Crash, nothing went wrong.
No. I know you didn't. But I
what were you
say
in?
That again.
What motor vehicle were you in?
We were in the most incredible 991.2 GT3 RS. That the price of the car. Price of the special options on the car were twice the value of the original list price of the car.
Wow.
Were you on the whole circuit? Did you do the whole circuit?
Yeah, we did. And I went out. The circuit's amazing. And to be honest with you, Chris was not really pushing it, but it's a very quick circuit.
That's a problem with Chris.
I'm not going to get all morbid here, but clearly there's been some pretty awful stories in the past. Someone that Chris knew particularly well from Monaco that didn't survive being a passenger in a car on a racetrack. And I just thought, this is just not a place I need to put myself in.
So can I just clarify? The extras on this 991.2 GT3 RS were twice the base price of the car?
Yeah, so if the base price was 150, the extras were 300.
Was this blue whale penis skin on the little slabs on the vest?
You can easily go crazy at CXX.
Don't ask.
This particular, you don't normally see tinted coloured carbon on a 911. Every bit of carbon on this car was tinted in colour, inside and out. Okay. Plus leather to sample. It was just, you know, his collection's just amazing.
And afterwards, Edward offered him about 160 grand for the whole thing.
Yeah. You lost those options, mate. I'll give you 150 grand. I'll give you this for it. anyway, on the road, I've got to say, I'm rarely a passenger. And
that's a really important statement in this.
That's true.
I don't think many of us are very often.
No, I'm rarely a passenger, but when I give my friends the opportunity to drive my cars when I'm in them.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I want them to experience what I experienced, the performance, the cornering, the braking. So I encourage them to drive the car in a spirited manner. What I don't need them to do is test the grip levels in a corner. That's the only thing I manage with them, is just making sure they're not trying to see what the front end or back end grip is like on a car. And that's all I've really got to say on the subject. I don't like being a passenger.
Yeah. Chris Cooper.
So I think the art of being a good passenger is finding a way of combining coaching skills, navigation expertise, general operational expertise and knowledge in how to set up the car. I think also acting as a spotter, so telling the driver what they might have missed, be it other road users or traffic signals or directions, offering a running commentary.
Oh, yes.
They're doing well and not well.
Oh, yes.
So, but most importantly, imbuing a sense of understanding in the driver as to the body language that they as a driver should convey in the car that they're driving. So I do this with Lynn quite a lot, actually, and she absolutely hates it. And I don't understand why. I can just imagine
you leaving home with being in the passenger, and but before you even got past Dingle Dell at the bottom of the gully or valley or whatever it is, she jumps out and swaps over. You can fucking drive.
That's exactly what happens.
I've just realised. I mean, you have missed your vocation. You should just basically, you should be a driving examiner. Can you imagine?
I wouldn't get out of the test centre. So at the bottom of our,
he should be a driving instructor.
Yeah. So at the bottom of the lane here, there's a single track lane. Bottom of the lane here, there's now some traffic lights, which is the bane of the modern world. Why can't you just have give way signs and people work out? Anyway, some traffic lights here. But there's a little gap just before where the T-junction hits the main road. And if you're waiting there, you can just get into the... So you're effectively in front of the queue. And I think that's an okay thing to do because it then conveys to somebody you're going to make progress. Otherwise, you're sort of sat there. When lights go green, is it me? Is it you? You, me? So I find myself saying to Lynn, actually, you can get into that space. Look, the lights are about to go. You get in there. Go on, get in there. Get in there.
Yeah.
She finds this really frustrating, and I don't know why. And I say, but it's good. And she says to me, how do you think I cope when you're not in the car with me? I said, you know what? I have no idea. I have no idea. So the only person I do with everybody. I tend to take over. I mean, Monkey said before, I will take over the controls because I'm a bit dyspraxic. I can't do left and right. Everything's left, whether it's right or left. So I have to point. So on our many journeys going across Europe, I would sit in the front of the car because Monkey would prefer to drive. And I have to say that's fair because he's whatever people might sort of like to imagine about Monkey, he's a bloody impressive road driver and obviously super fucking fast on the circuit. But as a road driver, that last bit going to the Nürburgring, because we've usually got something a bit tasty, I think I'm actually going to enjoy this. I'm not going to say a word. I'm just going to see. And it's just super smooth and it flows. And it's lovely and so forth. But on the motorway to there, all bets are off. No, Monkey, it's that way. It's that way. And I will literally put my hand in front of his face.
Mm. So that's the bit. So just to let you, I'll interrupt here because I'm aware of a lot of this. The first thing you need to know about Chris Cooper is to enjoy his company in a car, you need to really love him very much. Otherwise, it won't make sense to you and it might come across as being a little bit domineering. But what because he's got this dyspraxia thing with direction, these were called the fingers of truth and justice in the car. So wherever they went, you followed those, otherwise you got told off. But if he's sitting in the passenger seat of a right-hand drive car, if he wanted me to go right on the motorway, he would cover my eyes with his arm. And it would take a while for him to realise that I couldn't see where I was going. And quite often, we were going well over 120 miles an hour. So this arm would shoot out and go, it's that way. And the running commentary was always wonderful. So first of all, he'd get in the car from the start, get in the car and adjust all controls to suit him. So if I had it set and the temperature was good for me, it would all be changed.
Well, you had it wrong.
Now, this had never, ever happened to me before. But because he was paying for my racing and was being lovely, I wasn't going to argue. And it's taught me a lesson. I don't care now. People get in the car, I don't care what they do. As long as they don't change something terribly, it's fine. So Chris would take over. And what he would do is he'd give a running commentary. And the running commentary started out by being really, really busy. He would literally tell me what I was doing. But as he got to know me better and the years went on, and he got quite tired of even his own humour, he decided to make it more sparse. And then anything that's sparse hits harder, much harder. So what would happen is, there could be 20 minutes when we wouldn't talk about my driving, or he wouldn't acknowledge anything. We'd be mid-chat and he'd say, you could have done that better.
Yeah.
Or he'd say, that didn't go very well. these utterly, they're just crucifying phrases would just come out of nowhere. And I'd go, oh my God, I've got that wrong. But do you know what? If you've got someone who's driving you respect, this is becoming a bit of a mutual fellatio session, but he's obviously a very talented driver. If you've got someone that you respect in the passenger seat, you take their criticism. And I think one of the things we'll get to in a minute is if the person that's sitting in the passenger seat is either too good or too bad a driver compared to the other one, you've got fireworks because one of you has to bite your lip and the other one points out what's going on. But with Chris, I'm the first person I've ever allowed and the last person I've ever allowed to sit there and tell me whether I'm a bad driver or not. And he wasn't shy.
And the most important thing is you've got to like the same stuff on the radio.
Yeah.
Or the player. And you and I are both complete addicts for cabin pressure.
Yeah.
We listened to it again. We had that trip back from the ring from Paul Ricard.
Yeah.
In the Porsche press car, the Gen 1 991 RS.
XLG.
We did it, the XLG car, and we did it in one hit because we thought we'd learnt Ricard in the morning of a track day. We thought, bollocks, let's just drive home now. So we spent the second half of the day just driving home. On the day of the very first time you appeared on Top Gear TV driving a yellow TDF, which you'd driven at Paul Ricard the previous autumn.
I have.
We listened to cabin pressure and everything else, and we just... It was one of my favourite ever drives as a passenger. We actually split it a bit, but it was just lovely because we both liked the same stuff.
Hmm.
And I did a bit of coaching.
And actually, I think, let's just see what Neil Clifford says, but passenger, I'd reach the same conclusion as Edward, that I'm not a good passenger. But actually, there have been times when I've really enjoyed being a passenger. So Neil Clifford, what do you think?
I cannot name a time that I've enjoyed being a passenger. And it's funny because I was sort of contemplating this. Why is this? Why, you know, because it's because if you enjoy driving, you're sort of annoyed that someone else is driving and you're not, and you're a passenger and you're not. The thing that you love almost most of all is it's been taken away from you. Someone else is doing it. And I'm the what did someone call me the other day? I'm the connector. I'm the organizer of often are sort of mates trips, the Le Mans or driving to the Pyrenees or whatever. And I coordinate it all and I make it all happen and book the house or whatever. And I say to my, actually my PA does a lot of it. It sounds terribly wanky, doesn't it? And she says, well, how many of you going? I said, well, there's 11. Well, how many bookings on the Eurostar do you want? Well, obviously 11. You know, there's 11 blokes and 11. There's 11 blokes and 11 cars. The worst thing would be if you had to go with another bloke in a car, in your little trip that you've, you know, takes you bloody 3 months to organise it. You do it every year if you're really lucky. I think post-COVID, it's all gone tits up, all of that stuff, isn't it? Some, we all like to be a bit more alone now than we used to. I think it's terribly sad. We need to do more stuff together with blokes, not being passengers driving silly places. So the only time I'm really a passenger is with my blessed wife. And what I tend to do is be very annoying for her because I'm worried about the wheel hitting the curb or, you know, is she, has she seen the car on the right when she's over? So I tend to sort of keep my mouth shut, be a bit annoying and feed her wine gums is about the only constructive thing I can do is unwrap sweets.
Yeah.
And, you know, because we're not clever enough to buy these Edward Lovett style water bottles. So we get the big 2 liter Avignon and you've got to keep taking the lid off for her and, you know, giving her water and then giving her another Murray Mint or something. It's about the only constructive thing I do as a passenger.
Brilliant. Passengering. You don't do that much driving. So how much passengering do you do?
No, I can, you know, get passengered a bit. And I think music, something, you know, whoever said that, I think that's so important. If you, and the driver has the veto. I mean, that's the big deal about it. I don't think the driver can't. And so if you're a passenger, for example, with my sister, who's 14 months younger, but is about 13, it's a very, very painful experience listening to basically the equivalent of K-pop. Or its English equivalent. That's very annoying. Secondly, for a while, she and her husband had a very nice 911 convertible, but I've never been convinced she ever learned how to change gear. And that was particularly painful in that car. So it's such a beautiful car. I mean, she's the only person I know who lets go of the throttle before she changes up, rather than going the other way and blipping. And the other thing I do is I always find her braking points absolutely terrifying. So my big thing is you're sitting there, you're trying to shut the fuck up, you're being driven somewhere, so you can have a drink, she maybe won't. And what you're doing is you're constantly braking. And then she starts to spot it. She can see your right leg twitching. And turns and goes, is there something wrong with my driving? No. You just sit there, no, nothing at all. What are you doing? What do you do? And then the other thing that she does is she knows where she lives very, very well, and she will often go the wrong way up a one-way road. Wow. And then goes, everyone does it. Like that. It's not something I absolutely love. And I mean, I've been a passenger with Mr. Harris. I don't know if you remember vaguely telling me off, but remember when we were in Italy? We were driving and I was convinced we were in the wrong lane. I sort of said, rain through.
I was just hanging in different lanes, yeah.
No, it was great. You turned around very coolly and you said, I've done this for a bit, boss.
It's not my first barbecue, yeah.
I think passengering is interesting for me. There's a sweet spot for it for me. And I realise that most of the time I want to be, if I'm not driving, I want the person driving to have one of a few roles. They've either got to be someone that I'm so interested in being in the company of that I don't care if they're a good driver or not. You know, if it's a sporting hero of mine or someone that I just wanted to meet, I wouldn't give a shit if they couldn't drive at all. It would be a chance to have uninterrupted contact with them, and that's a privilege. So I'd be okay with that. I need it to be either a great driver or it needs to be someone that's in control of a vehicle that I wouldn't be allowed to be in unless they were driving it. And outside of that, unless it's one of my children, I'm getting pissed. I don't really want to be in the passenger seat. I have to say, I'm not very good at it. Yeah. I don't passenger very often. At the moment, the only time I really passenger is when I'm giving my son a little go in the car because he's about to do his test. quite soon. So yesterday I went for a little drive in the Gulf that we have. And we were just out in Bristol going around, L plates on, just going round and round. And I, as we were going down a particular residential part of Bristol, I said to my eldest, I said, that's a plain clothes car. I know those. There's a few of those around. And quite often they're the armed response units as well around here. So I said, it's nice to see that they're out and about looking. Anyhow, about 3 minutes later, I spot the fact this thing's done a Yui and is now following us. And I thought, there's an outside chance he spotted me, but that's weird and he wants to have a chat. I don't really see that. We're in a Golf. It's not a fancy car. So I start making sure we're going round and round in quite large circles on streets. And this thing follows us down every weird little turning. And I think, well, I've had enough of this. What's going on? So we pull over on a main road in Bristol and it pulls up behind us. So I jump out confidently and I go towards the police officer who's already walking towards me quite confidently. And so I say, is there a problem? He said, yes. This vehicle number plate comes up on a national register of vehicles involved in serious crime. And I went, okay. And I didn't know what to say, really. I said, well, I'm just having some driving lessons with my boy. And he said, well, it is. It's a bit of a problem, actually. And I went, okay. I said, I hate saying this, but do you recognise me? He said, I do. And he said, I'm aware of the fact you've had a bit of time on your hands as well. So I thought, here we go.
He's a bit cheap.
No, he was lovely. He was lovely. Anyhow, he then said, there's another problem. It's not insured. I went, okay. So my son is now thinking, this is the worst driving lesson I've ever had. I don't know anyone's had a worst driving lesson. But I'm the passenger, but I'm supposed to be in control. But my poor son has all his records read through. Luckily, his license is okay. The insurance thing is a clerical error. My insurer had written the number plate down wrong on the insurance document. I had the insurance document, but it had the wrong number plate on it by one letter. You could tell that.
Oh, wow.
And he very kindly let us go. But this is the worst bit. How about this? Imagine being that age. And because it was flagged on the computer system as a serious crime, a vehicle potentially involved in serious crime, the number plate's been cloned, obviously. Every police car in the area was flagged to join them. So by the time this had stopped, there were several police cars behind.
That's fantastic.
And we were parked on a hill. We had a hill start away with all these police cars behind him. And I just sat there and I looked at him and I said, I don't know what to say, but you really don't want to fuck this up. He let go and the car started rolling back. Panic and we'll laugh about it forever. I'll do that as a passenger. But the rest of it, I think Neil Clifford is absolutely right. I think if you love cars, and there's only one species that outside of this, and David Richard is one of them. A co-drivers, I can't. There's another episode in co-drivers.
There is.
They are wonderful, but they're mad. But unless you're one of them, you want to operate the machinery because you're in love with the machinery and operating. Yeah. And what, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're a Neil Clifford who says tires make no difference and steering feels made up, or you're like me who's into all that stuff. Fundamentally, you like operating machinery, and that's what binds us all, I think.
Yeah, I'm jealous. If I'm a passenger, I'm basically just pissed off and jealous.
Yeah, I think
and,
you're right.
And I manifest that by taking over.
Yeah. And I think I'm the same. Yeah. Okay.
Very good.
This one's we're getting on a bit here, so we're going to go this next subject. Is very interesting. Gunter Steiner has left his role at Haas F1. He left last week, didn't he? And the press release used the phrase "with immediate effect," which is never a nice thing to read. What do we make of Gunter? What do we make of his impact on the sport and the role he played in the post Drive to Survive era? Manish, what would you say?
I think this is a very tricky one, actually, as a subject, because Gunther actually has been around quite a long time. It was Niki Lauda who brought him into Formula One, and that was sort of 20 years ago at Jaguar. And then off he goes to NASCAR, and he's done, you know, he had a carbon composite company with part of USF1, except he wasn't. But that whole preamble really gets you to how he ends up. And what a strange team, in a way, Haas is, because it's just not a normal Formula One constructor. My understanding is that very, very early on, it was his business concept, which was let's basically, the rules say we can have as much of Ferrari as we want. So I'm going to go and see Stefano and have a chat with him because he was running Ferrari and say, look, does this work for you as a business model? And Stefano's like, it does, go and get the money and we've got no problem. So you've got this very strange team that, you know, originally, I mean, it's got three bases. So they kind of run the team out of England, but then it's got the design and the aero actually at Maranello. In theory, there are Chinese walls between it and Ferrari, but, you know, who knows whether you go for a pizza with a good mate around the corner. I mean, I don't know. And then you've got this sort of base in North Carolina. And I think in some ways that is the impossible job. And I think if you look, their best season's their first season because it's got the most Ferrari in it. And after that, the FIA are squeezing every, you know, the rules are getting tighter and tighter. And of course, if you don't make a car, you don't have that level of expertise. I think it can only go in one direction. But I suppose the question is, how do we feel about why Gene Haas pressed the button? And there are a couple of things which seem quite tough, actually. First of all, this man has been around and he's achieved what he's achieved. But I think he says that he was fired in a way over the phone that meant he couldn't say goodbye to the team, which I think is very harsh when you've really been a founder of the team. Yes, you're an employee, but you are a founder. And I think that's very tough. And, you know, to refer to Haas's results as embarrassing, I get it, but they have a peculiar business model. And I suppose my question would be, what next? And this guy, Ayo Komatsu, has taken over. And he used to be Roman Grosjean's race engineer back in the day. So you're kind of wondering now, they've got a technical director, they've got a team boss who's effectively a race engineer. And
we've been down that route before, Binotto, haven't we? It doesn't work.
Well, yeah. So you do wonder. And I think all I would say is that if this is all puckering the team up for a sale, you know, and that behind the scenes, maybe there was a kind of big disagreement about should we sell or not, then fair enough. And, you know, and the converse line is what Bernie said about him in June 2023. You know, he's a very famous guy, famous for losing, you know, which he didn't like at all. So
Did he say that about Gene Haas or Gunther?
Oh, sorry, I thought he said it about Gunther.
Yeah.
I thought he said it about Gunther. I wouldn't have thought he'd say that about Haas, but I've always wondered kind of what is it that Haas were doing in Formula One? I mean, it's great being lucky in your first year with this model and reasonably lucky a couple of years later, but, you know, you're tooling around in ninth or tenth when that's not necessarily your core business. You've got a NASCAR team, you've got a machine tool business. I don't know why you do it.
Yeah.
Neil Clifford, do you care?
I just like the fact he swears a lot. Yeah. You know, he probably was the star of the Netflix thing, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And I, in a way, because I don't know that much about the whole thing, I'm a normal spectator of F1, trying to know a bit more because I have to sort of talk about it a little bit. I think he was the star of that show to many respects because you're like, what a character. And we all like characters, don't we?
Yeah.
I don't, you know, clearly I have no idea why he was fired. I've seen the rumours about it being sold and all of that.
Yeah, Gene Haas says no. I mean, maybe you would do.
Yeah. But you can imagine, you know, as an owner or a leader with Gunther working for, you can imagine, even if you love him, I can imagine you being also very pissed off with him because he's probably quite unmanageable as a character. If you've got to manage, you know, the responsibility of managing people and all of that, he might drive you a little bit mad. I could quite easily see you having a bit of a sort of ding-dong on a few issues. And it's a shame because he seems to be an immensely likable chap.
You don't think he'll find another spot in F1? I suspect he will.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you'd give him a job as a commentator immediately, wouldn't you? But I'm sure you don't earn 2 or 3 or 5 million quid doing that.
Well, I suspect if Liberty have their way, they'll make sure he's in there just so he's a part of the next series of Drive to Survive. Chris Cooper, what do you think?
It's not a huge surprise, is it? We met him very briefly because he was at the Nürburgring 24. I think he was at Nürburgring 24 Hour Race in 2002. Because
how do you remember this stuff? I don't even know what my name is. How do you remember that?
Well, because if you're a bit weird and dyspraxic like me, you can associate stuff with years. So I know that it was 2002. Because that was the year that I made you wear that ridiculous coloured polo shirt that you once did one of your whiskey diaries with. Yes. And actually, one of my sons said to me, because he saw it recently, that whiskey diary thing you did in that car in the COVID with that, with the Challenge Consulting and the catering 24-hour polo shirt. And even one of my boys said to me, Dad, what were you thinking of when you made Monkey wear that?
Well, it's just, it was the colour of diarrhoea. Anyhow, carry on.
It was a bit pooey. Because Martin Leach, who was in the other auto car,
the Focus,
a mate of mine who used to help run Martin Leach's go-kart a million years ago had left Raynard because he'd gone pop. And I went to see Martin because I sat next to him in Parc Fermé right into that race. And the Focus happened to be next to us that your mate Steve Sutcliffe was also in. Hello, Martin. I'm in the other car that's just beaten you. While we're here, my mate John from Raynard needs a job, and you've got Jaguar. And he said, yeah, actually, Gunter's here. And Gunter was just become technical director. But before that, he was in the Ford Rally team. So he's he was a technical director for the Focus, Colin McRae time.
He's got a bit of a Jos Capito career move thing.
A bit of that, isn't there? Yeah. There's a bit of that. But I just, you know, it's a results-orientated business. And I suspect Gene probably got a bit fed up thinking, does he really care? Has he really... He's a funny character. He's from that part of Italy that... Because he sounds Austrian. You think Gunter Steiner, that's an German or Austrian name. But he's Italian.
Hmm.
He comes from that bit of the Italian Dolomites that Austria and Italy have traded over. That's probably a polite way of putting it.
Tyrol, the South Tyrol, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's probably, it's a results-orientated business. They've seen how James Vowles has started to revitalise Williams. I mean, Williams might be pants this year, who knows? And I'm probably just thought, do you know what? We're going nowhere, we're going backwards. They had a great car on Saturday. They just went backwards on Sundays. So very sadly, I suspect.
They always last.
They weren't in quali. In quali, they were very... They're quite often in Q3.
Yeah.
Nico Hülkenberg, who was...
Wasn't he the most overtaken driver this year?
Because of his qualifying versus his race.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think the most overtakingest driver was Sergio Perez.
Yeah.
Because he was always starting near the back because he popped up Saturdays, had the fastest car.
Yeah.
So go the other way. So Nico Hülkenberg was the most overtaken driver. So yeah, it's I suspect you're right. I mean, he made famous a new way of saying the F word. Fucking.
Yeah, he's great.
Fucking. Gunter fucking Steiner.
Edward Levitt. What do you feel?
I don't feel much. If they could just fire a few more people during the off season, so we can mix it up a bit for this season to come, that would be nice.
Yeah. We won't get that, unfortunately.
I think part of the interesting thing for me is the sort of cult of personality and celebrity, because it's the only time in my life where I've been very connected to a sport, thought I knew about a bit about a sport, but because I wasn't watching Drive to Survive and I haven't really watched much of it at all, the emergence of Gunter Steiner, the celeb, was totally bizarre to me. So you'd watch him sort of... It was amazing watching commentators and people's reaction to him change over the last 3 years, but of course I wasn't aware why it was changing.
Yeah,
there was a bit of reverence towards him and a bit of sort of how cool he was, but I'm just thinking he just runs a team that's getting nowhere, and I couldn't really understand why he was, you know, ever wanted to talk to him. But now I do. I'm trying to watch a couple of episodes and I can see, I totally agree with Neil, he's hilarious.
Yeah,
it's funny, but I think, and the reason why I asked, I think I wanted to talk about this is it exposes the paradox of Formula One and of motorsport, in as much as if there's any sport that's never really wanted to celebrate failure or people that are part of failure, it's Formula One. And Gunter might be the first example of someone who became a celeb.
I think that's right.
For being a part of the slow end. You're never fettered. Every other sport has its Eddie the Eagle or Eric the Eel that breaks the mold. Formula One has never celebrated slowness. It's always found it offensive and unprofessional,
loserish.
There's no way around it. And Gunter was the first person, I think, to embody celebrating being at the non-pointy end. And I wonder whether that sat well with the sport or not.
I suspect it probably did, but didn't sit at all well with the bloke who was employing him.
Yes, yeah, and I can imagine that you'd wake up one day and think,
"Why am I getting out of this?" Yeah.
If I got my tech people to do a simple word association Google search now, with if you type in Haas F1, what's the first word you say? It would be Gunther.
Yeah,
and I think he'd be a bit pissed off with that after a time, and maybe
there's just one teeny tiny counter argument. Something he said yesterday, or a transcript of an interview he gave, and he said, no matter what you think of Drive Survive, he was instrumental in keeping the team alive after COVID because of the sponsorship they got.
He did do that.
On his fame. So his exposure, if it's not going to be on track, it's going to be at the end of the year on 10 hours of television.
Yeah.
And I think you've hit the paradox right on the head. Is this sport or is this the show business? And you got it. If you can't win, the best way to do it is deflect with a bit of sweary humor. And you got the sponsors, you got the airtime, you're there.
Yeah. Right. We're going to move on to Two Car Garage. I've got, I'm going to miss out a couple of words. Now, is this, it begins under the radar cars. Is that the one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I can't, I've got it wrong. Can someone read it out to me? Because I've screen grabbed it wrong.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Andrew Hirst Cars. It's a recession year.
Yeah.
You're looking for two under the radar cars, which won't attract too much attention on the road. One must be a coupe / two doors, brackets, no convertibles.
What?
No convertibles. Two door coupe. And the other, a four-door saloon sedan for our American cousins, or an SUV. As you are a very successful entrepreneur, the budget is unlimited. Both cars must be on sale today / new, as safety, boys and girls, is a concern. Most importantly, Andrew tells us, choose the paint colours wisely. I like that.
Oh, I forgot the paint colours bit.
Andrew will be so upset.
No, I know my pain.
Go on, say metallizzato with that little nasal thing you do. Go on.
Metallizzato.
There you go.
That's not the way I thought you were going to say it.
No, that's not the way. I can't remember the nasally way I said it. Metallizzato.
Okay, I'm going first. Now, this is so unimaginative. And I look and sound like part of their press department, but I'm going straight to crew because I'm getting in there quickly because I reckon Clifford might be following me up the M5 and the M6 quickly, and I want to get there before he does. And I'm going to double dip. I'm going to buy a Conti GT as the two-door, and I'm going to have myself a Spur as the four-door. I don't want the SUV. They're both going to be in Brewster, and they're both going to have Cohiba Hyde. They're going to be fully optioned. They will not have any kind of personalised number plate, so they won't look like they're his and hers cars or hers and hers or his and his. But I just, for me, right now, Bentley answers every single question I ask about my everyday motoring.
Which bit of under the radar does that...
I was going to ask that. I mean, how under the radar...
They're under the radar, aren't they?
He might be in like Dubai or something like that. It'd be under the radar in Dubai.
Dark green, no one's going to spot it.
It's a recession year. You're looking for two under the radar cars.
What? Read the bit about the budget.
Budget is unlimited.
If
you're into cars, which bit's more important? Under the radar or no budget?
Andrew, I'm really sorry.
No budget always wins.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
No budget.
I was going to answer this with...
You've missed a massive opportunity if you've gone budget because there was no budget. Mm-hmm. Over to you, Mr. Cooper, so we can hear you drip on about some shit Toyota you're going to buy so that you're employed, so that you're kind.
You can fuck right off. So, Andrew, I've chosen the under the radar M2 comp. That I'd send to Licho and get Licho to spend all the money in the world on, including painting it or doing that lovely rapidos in BMW 287 code Mauritius Blue.
Is that dark? Is it Mauritius?
These are supposed to be new cars, aren't they?
Yeah. It's a new car. Yeah.
They don't do a competition M2.
So what's the current M2 then? Sorry.
Not a competition. You've lost.
Oh, dear.
So picky.
Oh, dear, Chris.
Another one. And the other one, all I can hear is a bloody droning noise. Reminds me of too many times I'm a passenger. The other one would be a B3, Alpina B3 wagon. Clear glass, decaled, under the radar, Alpina green, that tobacco-y interior colour, M2 non-comp, new one. Mauritius Blue, B3 wagon.
So just to be clear, the second one said it was a four-door or an SUV, nothing about being allowed an estate car. Carry on.
I didn't read that bit.
Yeah.
I have caught that up.
All in all, a 2 minutes to forget for Chris Cooper.
I have just done that.
Let's move on to Neil Clifford and we'll leave. Chris.
And then I'm not a successful entrepreneur, so I'm Chris, allowed to
Chris RTQ Cooper can stay there. Neil Clifford, are you going to stay within the rules or not?
Yes. In fact, I'm talking about real life. I've just recently done this. Not to say I'm a successful entrepreneur, but I've certainly bought the two cars that I'm now going to talk about.
Oh, I like it. Carry on.
Yes. I'm buying an Alpina.
Yes.
And I did note just at the end in time, as you read it out, that it wasn't about a touring. So
yeah, I didn't read that bit, even though I read it out.
In real life, obviously, I've got a touring. In fantasy world, i.e. two car garage, I'm having a saloon.
Yeah.
I'm having a B5 because they're not big enough, those threes, for me. I agree with you.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's B5, saloon, and no stickers, probably anthracite, chocolate leather, clear glass, obviously, no badges. Lovely. And then I'm going to, and these almost match these cars, don't they, in terms of words, an Alpine.
Yeah,
I'm going to buy a little Alpine because I think that is the most under the radar sports car.
Yeah,
I have bought one. I don't have it yet. I'm looking forward to get it. It's with Ian Litchfield. It's coming on Monday. I'm very excited. I've lowered the seats. I've put the spacers on. I've got those little thingies, the Life 110 Life things. I'm about 4 years behind on this car. And I'm really looking forward to it, actually. And I think they are very under the radar, low-key machines of pleasure.
They are. Yeah. All of that.
Good choice.
Manish.
I'm afraid I fucked this up completely.
You can't really have made more of a mess of it
than RTQ up there.
Oh, I don't know. I did the bit that I missed out. I just saw the words, because I saw both cars must be on sale today, I assume somewhere. I didn't see that stroke new as safety is a concern. So
you've bought a Lamborghini Countach as always.
safety is a concern. Safety. I did buy a car with an airbag. So my first one would always have to be a 456 MGT in Tour de France blue with cuoio naturale leather. And it does have an airbag. I'm going to get the one with a big steering wheel. Now, my second one, I was thinking boxy cars are always under the radar. If a car looks like a box, it's under the radar. And if a car is boxy and looks a bit old and 70s, it's very under the radar. So I found this on Kidston's website. He sold this a few years ago. And it is a 77 Monteverdi 375 stroke.
Yeah, that's a great car.
In metallic blue with red seats. I think people would walk past that and go, bah.
That was Simon's own car, that one.
Was it?
I'm not sure that's under the radar.
bit of dog dick leather inside there.
Manish, remember, the most important part of this was The most important part was the limitless budget. Forget the under the radar thing.
Yeah.
Don't forget about that. Chris Cooper really missed a chance here.
Okay. Do I look like I'm bothered? Actually, I'm quite bothered.
Edward, what are you going to do?
So I've taken this quite seriously.
Save us.
Well, fine. So my two-door coupe is going to be the brand new, I'm sure soon to be delivered, you might be able to get one in Germany, Mercedes AMG GT. Because they sort of pulled back on the aggressive design of that car, haven't they? They've tried to make it more sort of Carrera 2, standard Carrera 2 911. So that would be my sort of understated sports car coupe. And then my new car is going to be one of these Toyota Century SUVs. I've got a hankering for one of
those.
You've
got like that.
A real thing about these buses now, haven't you?
Well, no, that's not really a bus. I watched a video. I just like the story of the original Century. And if they do, they get one of those then. Well, just you wait till this jumper changes in a minute.
That's all of us done, isn't it? Okay, let's go for some quick music. Edward Lovett.
I don't know the artist, but I'm going to tell you in 2 seconds. Hold on, caller. The song is called Ferrari. It's out at the moment. I thought it seemed like a appropriate song to accompany the movie. And I think by here, it's by James Hype and Miggy Della Rossa. There we go.
I like it. Whenever he says the names, Manish just looks around as if someone's farted in the room. Right. Manish, what are you going to go for?
I don't know if someone's picked this before, but I heard this yesterday and I just remembered how grand it was. And in a car, I have heard it is All Along the Watchtower, Jimi Hendrix.
Nice.
You become with Nail and that's who you are.
It's good.
Chris Cooper.
Again, I'm not sure whether we've had this, but, and I can't quite believe this is true, this year marks 40 years since Van Halen released the album Jump. 40 years. And the eponymous title track, Jump.
But we have both chosen that twice already, I think.
Who cares? It's 40th anniversary. We're bloody having it again. Van Halen Jump.
It's one of the greatest songs. Okay, Neil Clifford.
If you've got three older brothers, you're like I have. I was the last attempt of a girl. You're bound to have three older brothers that are all into The Who.
Yeah.
Therefore, I am a Who fan. And Who's Next is the best album. And Behind Blue Eyes is just a great
song.
Yeah.
So I was having a think in the car the other day. Who are my favourite female singers, the ones proper warblers, not pop singers, but some of them obviously sang pop songs. And I reckon in my this woman is in my top five. Annie Lennox, I think, has just gone when she was on proper super unleaded, late 80s, early 90s, and she was she'd been to Litfield and she was like map stage 3.54. She was on it, and I reckon on one of her solo albums, a song called Little Bird, when she really gets going,
nice.
It's a cracking tune. Get it on. It's fantastic. Really, really great tune. So that was episode 49 of the Collecting Annex podcast, and we're not about to record the next episode 50 immediately after this.
Not in any way.
We're having a simple change of clothes. So I'm now going to make my change of clothes to do the record because Edward wants it to be so that no one spots the fact that we've done it. So if I
look, hang on a minute, we've got
I'm
to do
wearing a, this in the next episode. You know, we just stopped before I started the next one. Okay,
but we've got to have to do a very quick pause so we can do an edit.
Okay, and then Johnny, we're stopping now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.